Well, are you ready? Are you ready, my friend?
I was born ready. I'm just making sure everything's turned off here so nothing can beat
Okay.
me.
All right. Today, I'm very excited because we have Steve Cockrum. He is probably one of the best leadership experts out there. I'm excited to have him because he's written several books on leadership. He is the father of the five voices, which, if you're into personalities, I think it's the Myers-Briggs on steroids. I just think it's a brilliant way of communicating personalities and self-awareness. And he is the godfather of this. So I'm very excited to have him. So, Steve, welcome.
Jim, thank you. I always love my American introductions because you really mean it and you are really kind. It's quite an anathema for us Brits to be told we're that good. So I always feel I can only disappoint with that type of introduction, but grateful for your kind words and sentiments, heart that lies behind it.
Steve, I've come to know you so much better than you know me through all of your videos and all of the books and all of the things that I've read about you. I've read all of your books probably more than once. I've been through the giant material so many times, and there's just a richness of information, not because it's just great information, but because it's got depth to it and it's sincere. And it's very, very practical. I think it's just incredible practical.
I should have used you as my marketing expert a long time ago, Jim. So, yeah, thank you.
But it's never too late, Steve. It's never too late. Let's talk a little bit about the five voices. What I want to do is, kind of go back into you thinking about this. So you're an expert on MBTI, you're using it. You're having a lot of success with it, but there was a need to create the five voices. Can you talk to me a little bit about that journey? Why did you need to create it? Why did we need five voices? What was the origins of this story?
So I'll try and be succinct, Jim. It's not my superpower. Basically, Jeremy and I were working on the assumption 13 years ago that actually in history, roughly every 200, 250 years in Western history, there's been a technological breakthrough that changes the world of work. And when the world of work changes, the skills of leadership have to change with it if you're going to stay relevant. So whether that's the printing press or the rotary steam engine, they seem quite simple to us, but actually they had profound impacts on the information age or on the industrial revolution or whatever it was. So our belief was that we were coming to the end of the industrial age and we were about to enter the digital age. And we're probably seeing, AI as another iteration of that. But if that was true, then the question would be is, well, what was going to be different about the new world? And we interviewed about 1,000 leaders and asked them what were the five biggest challenges they were currently facing. And what was really interesting was a number of them, Jim, were distinct and different from the things that had been written about for the industrial world, because the issues that people were facing with, like a world where work doesn't stop in the digital world, or where you're having to lead through influence far more than positional power. I think the key one, though, was that gets to where you're going was it was the new world is visual far more than it is auditory. And therefore, if you're going to teach and communicate in the new world, it has to be visual, interactive with immediate application. And team, the ability to create agile, collaborative, high-performing teams became more important than talented individuals. So if that was true, then basically what we said was, well, look, the new world is so overwhelmed that people are being bombarded with demands the moment they come out of any training or any investment. The tsunami of digital data overwhelms them, and then they're dealing with a world that's changing around them as well. We said that everything we designed for leaders for the new world, an educated 13-year-old had to be able to understand it, use it, and teach it to their friends. If it was any more complicated than that, it could be sensational in the room, but it wouldn't be visual interactive with immediate application. We had to basically make things simpler. And the concept, even though we write books, they're more marketing positioning, because most leaders don't read books anymore, they don't have time. So our belief was leaders in the digital world needed a better toolkit, they didn't need a bigger library. Now, you and I still read books because we're geeks. So therefore, my Myers-Briggs stuff, and Jedi mind tricks and all the things that I've built on top of it, and William Schutz's stuff, my educated 13-year-old at the time, Isabel, says, Daddy, I love the fact I'm an ENFP. I love the fact I can understand it. I love the fact you've discipled and grown me using it. And I use it every day, but it's too complicated to teach to my friends. Mm. Doesn't that violate the principles that you and Uncle Jeremy say you're building Giant upon? So wow. I went, well, you know, being a pioneer, I never admit I'm wrong immediately. I just buy myself time and try and deflect blame. So I would say, Izzy, thank you for that. Let me go away and think about it and I'll come back to you. That was the genesis, Jim, of saying, you're right. MBTI is way too complicated to be the scalable solution for large organizations and teams in a world that is moving at the speed we move right now. So Voices was written in the source code, so we didn't lose any of the power of the Jedi mind tricks, but we actually created a vocabulary and language which we found actually is meaningful enough that people go, wow, this is really helpful, but it's scalable enough that basically you don't have to have an expert in the room every time you use the vocabulary language. And if you're running a, I don't know, X hundred or thousands of people organization, you can't afford for a Jedi master to go in and work with every team. There has to be a way in which we can train and certify internal experts and also create vocabulary language which can be passed on. Because ultimately, when I get healthy, I can share with you what I've been learning, and therefore that was why Voices became an essential component of the growth of what we did. Now, the amazing thing is having five voices in order meant not only could I keep my 16 personalities, we actually created even more depth and concept, because in a sense you can work with your foundational voice, but you can go a lot deeper with Voices than you can with a lot of the other simple, easy to use personality pieces. And we've been able to build a whole suite of, I guess, resources that leaders can then use with their team. So very long answer to a short question, but I still use both. But fundamentally, the only one I recommend to scale in organizations is the Voices, because the other just usually ends up getting abused. Somebody becomes overly keen and starts telling everyone what they are. And then people feel they're being, you know, manipulated, or somebody is. The therapy is only as good as the therapist when they're complicated.
That's really good. I love the fact that you talked about how your daughter was the aha moment for you. The aha moment for me was with my daughter. And when she was 6 years old, when I started learning about personalities, I would say, honey, it's time for bed. And what she heard was, it's time to fight about bedtime. And it was so frustrating. And then I started understanding personalities and how she viewed the world. And I changed my communication based upon her personality and my personality. And it was like the Jedi mind trick, you know. I said, Maddie, you can go to bed anytime you want. You're in charge. Nine's the limit. She's like, all right, then. Can I go to bed now? I will go to bed now. You know, it was just eye-opening, just that little communication. Because I understood her personality of that strong-willed child. So let me ask you this. On the five voices and other tools, you know, everyone seems to have their favorite. You know, it's like, well, we use DISC, and this is a wonderful tool, and we like Enneagram, and we like, you know, there's everyone who, they get stuck on one. How does five voices, I don't want to get into it's better, but how does it complement some of these other tools that are out there?
I think, Jim, being a pioneer, I'm highly competitive. So if you saying that mine's not the best, then we'll have a problem. But that's,
well, it is the best. There's no doubt about it. It is the best. You know,
here's the. I always say a therapy is only as good as the therapist. So in a sense, if you're going to use a tool, have someone who's really skilled at using it help you. So I know a number of people who use Colors or DISC or Enneagram or Berkman or Hogan, and they're brilliant at it, and they have superpowers. And when they work with a team or organization, it works really well. What I would say is that for me, there is a division between how do you be simple without being simplistic? So fundamentally for me, whenever I come across somebody who's, you know, an expert in a tool, I usually say, okay, do your darkest magic on me and I'll do mine on you and we see who wins. And in the end, what you'll find is that with DISC or Colors or some of the simpler or animals, it's great for the day. But if you really go back 2 years later and go, how much of this vocabulary and language are we actually using? Or, yeah, I've got my little sticker on my desk that here are my five superpowers or whatever it might be. How much is that learning actually transforming the way not just people relate to each other, but the way teams perform? So for me, personality is nice and it's great, like you did with your daughter. But if, for me, if I'm going to actually spend money as a commercial organization, bringing vocabulary and language and experts into my world, I want to know, does this actually drive performance change over time in a way that is tangible? So I always say a lot of the other instruments haven't done the hard work to build out the toolkit and the lenses that go beyond the initial personality. Aha, well, I'm a dog and a duck. I'm a pink with a white spot. I'm a red and a blue. I'm a DI, whatever it is. I think what we've done is we're right at the middle of, we're simple enough to use, but we're not simplistic. But what we have done is constantly say, in the end, if we're not able to help build agile collaborative teams, if we're not able to help leaders lead with greater influence, if we're not able to harness the superpowers of everyone in the team to a productive outcome, then we were a nice to have on an offsite. We haven't really become default vocabulary and language defining culture on the inside of an organization. So, you know, that will be my challenge. And on the other end, you have the really deep magic, like, you know, your Hogan's or your MBTI or Burton, whatever it is. They're only ever able to be used by experts. They just don't scale. You can't scale that knowledge because it requires too much skill. So I would say all of them are useful, depending on what you want to use them for. For us, I guess, ours was, if there isn't a true commercial long-term performance stickiness, then in the end, I go, you're probably going to end up in a year's time going, hey, we did that one. Why don't we do another one? And I'm always, if somebody who's done voices says to me, yeah, we did voices and now we're going to do this, part of me dies.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't do a good enough job, because once this is in your vocabulary language, it will stick. I mean, Google did it in their kind of data storage facilities. And at the end of the year, she said, all right, you win. She said, this is the stickiest stuff we've ever come across. Everyone uses this stuff even after we've stopped paying for you to be there. Why? Because we made it, I believe, commercially applicable. And it became something that addressed a pain, not a vitamin. So I would say, you know, I want to be a painkiller, not a vitamin, or vitamin, I guess, in your part of the world. Vitamins are really nice to have. Everyone knows you should take them. Most people forget.
Yeah.
Painkiller, if you've got toothache or a migraine and I've got something which will help you address it, I promise you, you will take it.
Absolutely.
So I think if you can, people understand that what we're doing is creating something that drives performance, and the KPIs that leaders get measured, bonus, and ultimately promoted against, we become a strategic partner and we ultimately create a greater degree of value. We've not necessarily, Jim, been as good at marketing as some of the others, but I would hazard a guess that whenever you meet people, as I do often, that have done a lot of these things, like you said, they go, your stuff is better than anyone else out there. Your marketing is just no good because no one's ever heard of you. And I go, all right, fair enough.
Well, you got to start somewhere. But I think that one of the other advantages you have is if you start thinking about the IQ, EQ, and PQ, actually knowing yourself. I think self-awareness is so important. So now you know your personality, but trying to understand your tendencies, trying to understand your default communication style. You know, so the communication code and the five gears and how that ties together, I don't think any other organization has done as good of a job to put those all into a toolkit that people can use.
I don't think people think that way, because most of the people who create content, Jim, are usually, they're part of the legacy of, they're brilliant speakers. They write great books and then they speak on it. Someone builds them a course. And then they sell that course to people that want a new stick to go in and sell to an organization.
Right.
So there's a pretty well-worn, and it works incredibly well, by the way. I mean, as a business, it works incredibly well. I think what we've done is often say, well, actually, we want to equip people to be agents of long-term transformation with the people they lead. And it starts with you. And so therefore, the concept of saying, well, if you're going to lead at an elite level in the world that we are now in, and AI is disrupting it further from even when we started 13 years ago, what are the skill sets you're going to actually have to learn if you're actually going to be somebody who's able to lead with confidence in the world we're in. And so therefore, a personality alone doesn't get you there. I mean, I might know who I am, but ultimately, I've still got to then, you said, I've got to learn how to engage with the people that I lead. I've got to learn how to communicate. I've got to learn how to manage stakeholders. I've got to deal with my own insecurities. I've got to stay physically, emotionally, intellectually healthy in a world where work never stops. I've got to be able to, I've got to try and work out, how do I be a good husband? In my case, how to be a good father. We're all dealing with a level of complexity in our worlds that really just didn't exist 30 years ago. You know, we went to the office, we came home, we went on holiday or vacation. Well, nobody contacted you for 2 weeks. Or, you know, if you're really cool like me, you had one of those brick briefcase phones that, you know, never worked, but you look quite impressive as you went through airport security. Whereas now, if you look at the hotel, we were in South France last week, by the pool, I reckon 3/4 of the people by the pool had their phones out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're navigating a new world. And annoyingly for people of your and my age, you know, had we been born 50 years earlier, we would now be the masters of all we survey, because we're of the age where we would now be in control of everything. Ironically, the generation coming through are far more skilled in the digital world than you and I will ever be. Mercifully, they're looking for people, authentic leaders who've actually, who match what they say with what they do, and they're crying out for mentorship and investment. But they're looking for not just what do you know, they're looking for is their integrity in what you teach aligned with who you are and the way that you actually show up at home, at work. We're no longer into the world which says, well, don't judge me by my morality if I do a good job. I think they're looking at leaders in a different way. And I think that's personally a good thing.
I think that's really good. That is an insight that a lot of people don't get, you know, where the younger age that is coming up and understands the digital stuff. Now, I'm a pioneer and I know digital stuff, so no one knows it better than I do. But there are younger people who I've been learning from that said, no, think of it this way. And I'm just blown away because they had a different growing up. I mean, I was. Yeah, absolutely.
I would say in Harry Potter world, you and I at best can be mudbloods. We're never going to be purebloods because we were born in the industrial world and we grew up, and in my case, we're educated in the industrial world, and we're now in a digital world. Whereas my kids, they've only ever known iPhones, emails, and computers. You know, it's quite eye opening to them to actually write essays with a pen.
It's really good. Now, personality types, I want to kind of segue a little bit here to different challenges on how people use them. Now, one of the challenges I see a lot of is pigeonholing. So you're an extrovert, you're in sales, you're an introvert, you're an engineer and accountant. And there's a problem with that. In fact, I think there's some challenges with lawsuits and people saying, okay, take the personality test and we're going to hire based upon this personality test. Can you give me some tales of caution or challenges with people putting people into a box or trying to hire based upon a personality?
So there's two different pieces there. So people like Culture Index or Predictive Index are saying we are able to take effectively the type of skills in the roles you're looking for and match them to what we think people are when they take our assessment. So that explicitly trying to do a first filter for you before you interview people. So that's one. You pay your money, you take your choice. I think there are elements of which that is actually helpful. I know some Jedis in those areas and they swear by it. Personality, Jim, is there is no personality assessment in the world that guarantees nature. So I would say to people, when you always be cautious of personality assessment, they always are more limited than the person who created them, even mine, would like you to believe. Because fundamentally, when I meet you and I see you on a screen and I encounter live Jim, as it were, I'm encountering a complex mix of nature, nurture, and choice. Roughly about a third each. So nature is your God-given DNA personality. I genuinely believe, like Jung, it doesn't change. I've done it for 23 years. Human behavior is very predictable. So nature is something which I believe you are born with. Nurture is the external environments that are unique to all of us that shape what we think we ought and should be. So where you grow up, your parents, your education, successes, failures, gender, ethnicity, faith, and what happens today. So nurture is a dynamic. You get a phone call now saying, you know, one of your loved ones is in intensive care because they've had a terrible accident. I promise you that impacts the way you behave and the way you think. So nurture is a dynamic. And then we have choice. So, you know, for me, the ability to go, I have real agency in the decisions I make. I look back over my, you know, 55 years now and go, gosh, some decisions I really think were great ones. Some I wish I could have again, but that's just being human. So all of a sudden then, that means when I meet you, I'm not saying, oh, here's Jim. He is definitely this by nature, because I don't know. Nature, nurture, and choice play roughly an equal part. And if pushed, I would argue that nurture in early life plays a bigger role than nature, because every child grows up wanting affirmation of authority figures. So an assessment really is telling you what you think you ought and should be right now based on the mix of nature, nurture, choice. So there's no assessment in the world. And I had a really interesting argument with an American VC group that promised me, he said, could you create me an assessment to filter out people that would be great investments for entrepreneurial endeavor? And I said, well, no. He said, well, I've got a professor in Zurich who's telling me he can. I said, well, I don't believe him. But if you want to spend your money, go for it. I said, here's why. You let me be with someone for 2.5 hours. I promise you, I'll tell you who their nature is. If I hear their nurture story, and the choices they made in their lives, I can give you and them a really good steer on what would be the challenges for you being an entrepreneur, what would be the difficulties, what would be the opportunities. But I can't do it, Jim, without actually being with people and having a chance to go deeper with them. Most of the time, it doesn't matter. If I work with an executive team, I'll always have one of my team do the nature assessment, which is what we use the Myers-Briggs for. But you can't do that for 12,000 people in an organization. So you have to settle for what is good enough. But always be careful, because people hate being put in a box.
Yeah.
Because the moment they go, you're telling me I'm this, but I don't think it does justice to the complexity of who I am, they tend to throw the whole thing out of feeling they're being, you know, limited in some way. When I say to them, guys, look, nature, nurture, choice. I know people like you, Jim. We may have the same nature, but we look different. We sound different. We think differently because nurture and choice have been unique. And what we found is when people have that level of freedom and expression, they go, I'm really interested to try and discover who, what my nature is, and also to understand how nurture and choice may be shaping my leadership behaviors in a way that I wasn't aware of. Because in the end, you're never going to lead at your best unless you're leading using, I believe, the nature, God-given giftedness you were given. So
yeah.
You can work incredibly hard at anything. Anybody, any personality can do anything. But ultimately, if you find yourself doing work which is outside your kind of the grace you're in, over time, you just get worn out doing it because it's not energizing and it's not you using your superpowers. That's the way I would describe it anyway.
I think that's really good. That's really good. And I think, you know, one of the benefits is actually understanding you and understanding your tendencies and not taking the mold and putting it on somebody else, but really going internal to say, okay, I have these tendencies that don't serve me well. And where do I need to bite my tongue? How do I need to shape these? How do I need to have more choice in these areas? Because those tendencies don't go away. I'm always going to have those tendencies. And I was thinking back on, you know, doing some consulting with a company. They were hiring a salesperson. They're all ready to pull the trigger on them. This guy was off the charts as a connector. He had absolutely no guardian in him whatsoever, or just very minute. And so he just talked and talked and talked and talked and talked and talked and talked. And he could probably pitch anything. But I said, you've got to have somebody with a little more nurture, a little more guardian to seek to understand what the challenges and the problems of your potential client are going through before we go into the pitch. You know, this guy might be able to pitch great, but if you're not understanding that person, I think you're missing something. We went with the person who had a lot more guardian, a lot more nurture, and they'd never had such a successful salesperson, but there were other things involved, not just the personality type, but I could look and say, you know, some of these tendencies although that's perfect for a salesperson because of the networking and all this other stuff, sometimes, you know, that tendency and that choice of just talking and talking and talking and talking can be a little overwhelming.
Yeah, I think I carry with me, Jim, are people who I really respect as being experts in their field who are doing things by nature they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
That's the way I get around the fact of going. So people say, oh, you're this thing, you can't be an accountant, or you can't. I go, no, I could do anything. But what you'll find is that certain personalities are overrepresented statistically in certain areas because it allows them to play more often to the way that they are actually made by nature. So, you know, is there an entrepreneurial personality? No, I know entrepreneurs of every, I know nurturers, guardians, connectors, creators, pioneers, are all. But are there certain attributes in the way people think, function, and enjoy and engage with life that make them more likely to enjoy and succeed the chaos of entrepreneurial startup? Yes. So therefore, you'll find there are more ENTPs or pioneer connectors as entrepreneurial business owners than there are in the 3.4% of the population. But it doesn't mean that anybody can't. It just means, you know, if my wife Helen's a nurturer guardian. I mean, they're amazing salespeople because everyone trusts them, but they just don't want the pressure of it. So do I know entrepreneurs or ISFJs? I know a couple because I collect them. But do they represent 11.8% of the entrepreneurial population in the way the nurturer guardians do? No. Because in a sense, it's really hard for people who are concrete, caring, practical, relationally intelligent, don't really like to be the center of attention all the time and love to be part of a team. It's not a natural habitat for them to become a sole entrepreneur and start their own business and tell everyone how amazing they are. So that's hopefully an understanding of why you see an overrepresentation of certain personalities in certain roles. But I always have a degree of reservation when someone says we're hiring for somebody and we're going to exclude this person because they're the wrong personality. I would sometimes say, to your example, if you have somebody who is an absolute incredible connector and your business right now needs a lot of kind of promotion, a lot of engagement, well, what you can do is you can hire them and just hire somebody to work with them who's really good at guardian detail. So the team creates the dynamic for success more than one individual in my experience now.
Yeah. The interesting thing is, I think that, you know, as far as entrepreneurs, Dan Diebel did five voices here with the Helzberg Entrepreneurial Mentorship Program, which these are very elite entrepreneurs. Of course, a lot of them were pioneers, but there's a lot of them that were very successful, nurture guardians, creatives. You know, there were a lot of other ones, you know, it's dominantly pioneer, but it wasn't all pioneer. And then the other interesting thing I found was a lot of successful entrepreneurs have this other aspect called dyslexia that made them extremely successful because in their brain and how it works, they have a gifting on spatial reasoning and to think outside the box. And that was an attribute of a lot of entrepreneurs that I studied. Now, when you think about the voices, I want to segue into mature and immature voices. So when we have a voice, mm-hmm. we have a mature voice and we have an immature voice. And Giant talks a lot about that. But can you talk about what let's say a pioneer, because we're both pioneers, what's an immature pioneer versus a mature pioneer?
So I'm a pioneer, connector, creative, guardian, nurturer. So I speak all five voices.
Okay.
Speak them in different orders and they blend together to make my voice with a capital V, which people hear and see and experience with me. So most of us, what you see is our superpowers are usually a combination of our first two voices, really. So when I'm being a pioneer connector, I'm helping make strategic breakthroughs. I'm connecting people to opportunities. I'm being strategic in the connections I make. I'm being a very persuasive, influential communicator, all the things that I love doing. So a mature pioneer has to be self-aware because I have to understand that I have, even when I'm trying to be nice to people, it still feels like I'm in a fight to the death if you disagree with my idea. So I like verbal jousting. I love debate. I love wrestling ideas to the ground. And I don't even mind if I'm wrong, as long as you're brave enough to wrestle with me towards a good outcome. Well, most pioneers, when they're immature, have no idea that everyone else, only 7% of people love doing that. In fact, the majority of people feel that type of intellectual, almost like a duel where one of us is going to die, deeply unattractive. And I carry, as a pioneer, a grenade launcher and wear Kevlar body armor into most intellectual debate. Well, if you're sat there with, you haven't got any armor and you haven't got any deadly weapons, and some pioneer comes and says, right, let's fight to the death over this issue of who's right or wrong, most people are going to look at you and go, well, it's not fair. You have no concept of what it's like to be the other side of you, because I may land a few blows, but you're going to eventually, if I really annoy you, go, and before I know it, I'm going to be blown up. Well, other pioneers carry Kevlar body armor and a grenade launcher. We can fight each other for as long as you want and go, this is great fun. But an immature pioneer only usually hears other pioneers, because no one else is capable of standing with an immature pioneer who ultimately says, I think I'm right. Tell me why you think I might be wrong, and be prepared to receive some of the grenades that come. So do you see the difference? An immature pioneer usually thinks they're right, usually thinks that silence is agreement, and only really values people that will fight to the death with them and wrestle intellectually. And therefore, a mature pioneer says, oh my goodness, I only really ever hear 7% of people's perspective, and they reinforce the echo chamber in which I live because they largely agree with me. There is a whole perspective and another complementary superpowers that are alien to me, that if I can create an environment where the creatives, the connectors, the guardians of the nurturers feel heard, valued, and appreciated, and more importantly, I believe that they have unique insights to bring, without which I'm not going to make the best decisions. The moment they believe I'm safe as a pioneer, that I've got a safety on my grenade launcher, that I really, really want to hear and wrestle and hear their opinion, and critically, I'm prepared to go last in the conversation, all of a sudden then, as a mature pioneer, I begin to hear things that I would never hear as an immature pioneer. So, you know, that's just an example, Jim, of where just about every young pioneer who is ambitious, driven, usually highly intelligent, and really ambitious for the future begins to realize, oh my goodness, nobody likes me. They might think I'm competent and they like being on my winning team, but nobody really wants to be led by me because I seem to be more preoccupied with my own win rather than helping other people's win. And that's the, you know, that's the painful journey of self-awareness that most of us go through, of going, oh my goodness, I used to love winning so much that I was competitive everywhere and nobody wanted to negotiate with me. Now I choose to lose more often than not. And I find my influence goes through the roof because people have always respected the competency, but what they see is character growth, which means I can win through the empowering of others more than I can win through me achieving everything on my own.
I love that. That is so good. That is so good. I think that, you know, as a earlier pioneer, I couldn't stand the guardian boys because they would ask these questions. And I'm like, I've already made the decision. We're going down this path, you know, having my spouse be a, you know, very, very high guardian. Now, as I'm older and mature, I really appreciate guardians. And I see that pioneer guardian aspect to where they're going to ask the tough questions. They're going to go through the details. They love checking off lists. They love that stuff. And when you pair them together, oh my gosh, what a powerful team.
Yeah. And I'd say for most pioneers, guardian is the easier to collaborate with than nurturer.
Mm-hmm.
That's the nemesis, because they feel people. So I, you know, now in years gone by, I just assumed I was a great communicator. Now, or anything goes live, I'll often use Helen, my wife, who's a nurturer guardian attorney, who basically I'll say, okay, what do you think of this? And she almost always says, you haven't sent this, have you? I'm like, what do you mean haven't sent this? She said, well, if you sent this, this is what I would hear. And I go, that's ridiculous, because that's nothing like what I'm trying to communicate. She said, well, if you sent this as an email to me, this is what I would hear. So then she says, we've learned how to do this. Would you like me to edit it for you? I said, yeah, I would. Okay. Small edit might be fine. Well, it comes back. It looks nothing like my original email. I'm going like, where's my email from? Well, you said you were trying to communicate this. And if you wanted to communicate it, this is how it should be written. And over the years, what I've realized, Jim, is she's a much better communicator than I am if I want to influence the majority of people. And I send it slightly dying on the inside because it doesn't really say anything of what I really wanted to say.
Yeah. But
everybody really receives it. And I'm like, okay, I'm not the best communicator in my family. Now, I may be the most charismatic of the communicators in our family. I may be the one who goes on stage and makes everyone laugh and is a good teacher. But when anyone hears my voice, they're always assuming Steve's really clever and he's trying to sell me something. And he's very, very good at selling what he believes in. Helen stands on stage. There's no oversell. There's no huge hype. There's no massive presentation. But when people hear Helen say, I think this is a good idea and I'm in, they inherently trust her far more than they trust me, which is deeply annoying. But once you understand that actually the team winning is more important than my idea winning, and even if it was my idea that we decided ultimately we would go with, I may not be the best person to communicate it to the wider organization. In fact, often what I'll do is I will celebrate and to make fun of myself, because pioneers who are prepared to laugh at themselves always just allow other people in and go, but in order for us to really hear what we're trying to say, I'm going to invite Helen or I'm going to invite Rob or whatever it is, because here's what I know is you listen to them far more intently. They do the detail better than I do. And ultimately, if they're in, you're more likely to agree. Well, that's maturity. Immaturity is like, of course, I'm the best communicator. Put me on stage, give me a microphone, I can persuade anybody. It's just not true.
That is just incredible insight. I really like that. Are you familiar with Dr. Daniel Amen, who does the brain scans?
I won't say I'm familiar with, I know of what it is and I know what it does, because people obviously who are trying to prove that, you know, personality is real, actually used a lot of his work to show, you know, the brain lights up in different ways with the same stimulus based on, you know, the way people are different. So that's been quite helpful, but I'm sure you know more than I do. So tell me.
I just started studying him a little bit, but he was talking about how he said there's 16 different brain types, you know, basically 5 brain types and then 11 offshoots, you know, he comes up with 16. And I thought about, that's Carl Jung. That's what he was talking about with the personality. And then Myers-Briggs took that to the next level. And as I went deeper, he says, yeah, I can do a brain scan and I can, you know, see what activities in the brain and how the brain thinks about things. And I can look at the brain and tell you, you know, a lot of personality traits of that. And I thought, I've done some research. There's a lot of scientific research out there on this other than what he's done. But I thought that was really interesting that you have a different brain type for people, and it's just how they're wired. That's how they see the world. And I thought that was really interesting, but I didn't know if there were any things that you might know as far as the brain scans and thinking of the brain and personality types and whatnot.
Well, I think in my case, Jim, it's not a huge surprise that people think differently. I think where it's been useful is for people who are healthily skeptical of these things and would like to know the scientific validity. So mm-hmm. For example, the academic community still struggles with Myers-Briggs, for example. They love the big 5. I can't quite work out why they love the big 5 more. But in a sense, though, I created 5 voices out of Jungian type and William Schurz. We ended up doing the validation through the big 5 because fundamentally that was people who were appropriately, you know, that was their credentialing. They actually said it's much easier for us to bring voices into our bigger organizations if we believe there is an intellectual validity behind what you've done. I'm like, well, I'm a pragmatist. I just want to help people. I promise you this makes a difference. I get emails every day from all over the world saying, hey, you really helped me with X or my daughter or my team or me. So that's kind of certain type of data, but they go, oh, the big 5 validates this thing. I go, yeah. There's this higher correlation between the big 5 and 5 voices than there are with any other personality instrument. So if that's where you want to go, that's why I'm grateful to some of my more academic brethren who basically say, Steve, I know you don't think it's important, but for some people it really is. So don't be arrogant and do the work or let people on your team do the work to kind of validate these things. So there's a whole science paper where somebody did like unified beautiful field theory, where effectively they've gone, look, here's all the personalities assessments you alluded to earlier. Here's how they map to the big five, and here's how they map to five voices. So you can look at these things and go, there's the highest correlation between the two. So I go, there we go.
Love it. Love it. I want to get into a couple situational scenarios with you and give you a couple stories, and they're fictitious stories. They might have some real validity in the background, but
the names
are protected. And yeah, so scenario one, this is the interrogation. So I'm going to use the person, John, who's a connector pioneer. He's juggling a very high pressure project. His boss, Gene, is a guardian pioneer. Gene publicly corners John at the Zoom meeting, and John freezes. He freezes because he's under a lot of stress. Gene gets very frustrated and blames him afterwards, you know, so he just says, shut down the meeting. Everyone else leave. I need you to stay with me afterwards. And he starts going through the, you know, the rapid fire questions, and the other person on the other end is just frozen. So it's a fright, flight, or freeze, and this person is frozen. I want to see if you were coaching both of those people, what are kind of some of the insights on how we could help them resolve this so this situation doesn't continue to happen?
Yeah. Okay. So it's not uncommon, by the way. Mm-hmm. I would say that the highest level of being able to use any of the personality instruments and toolkits is when you can help with synergy and conflict. When the lenses you're able to give leaders, give them an understanding of why things happen, because you have to change the way you think before you change the way you behave. So if all you do is change the behavior, but without changing the underlying framework of thinking which drives it, you will go back there again under pressure. So if you think about it, for an ENFP connector creative pioneer in John's case, he is bringing his ideas to the table, and he believes he's already done all the due diligence in the world and is looking for celebration. Ultimately, he's going, I wouldn't have brought you this if I hadn't already tested it with lots and lots of people. I think we're ready to go. And because it's so personal, part of John's superpower is he gets people and he's highly relational. So when we critique John, it's personal. However, Gene, on the other hand, is a guardian pioneer, ESTJ. Gene asks questions when she actually thinks the person she's asking is actually credible enough to want to bother asking the questions. So Gene is paying John a compliment by actually thinking it's worth engaging a critical, rational, analytical functions to basically make sure this idea is as good as it sounds to her. John, of course, hears that critique as, I don't believe you, I don't trust you, and I don't think you've done the work you should have done. So John becomes defensive and doesn't want to engage directly in a fight, because John's default is, when he feels slighted, is to withdraw and then use cyber warfare to basically poison Gene's reputation in the wider team. Gene doesn't understand, because she's ultimately saying, John, I really think there's something good here. I want to help make sure it's actually true. I'm going to do the due diligence. I'm going to ask the difficult questions, because before we go live, we really ought to test it. But I'm really interested. If I wasn't interested, I wouldn't say anything. So all of a sudden, you have a complete breakdown. John now thinks Gene is nasty, against him, negative, wasn't prepared to engage in the joy of the creativity. Jean is confused. She actually liked what John was doing, but he's run away and felt that her critique was deeply personal, hurtful and upsetting, and showed a lack of faith in his leadership. Well, here's what I do, Jim. I'd always coach them together.
Okay.
Because in a sense, you're basically saying, okay, I would say, okay, here's my hypothesis, guys. This is what I think happened. John, how does that sound to you? John goes like, that's exactly right. And then I'd ask some clarifying questions. So how did it feel when Gene asked those questions? And then go, okay, Gene, how does it sound to you? Well, how did you feel when John ran off and said all these things? So what I'm doing is I'm giving them an intellectual framework to understand what's happened is eminently predictable. But because it's predictable and they're both willing to learn, they can go, oh my goodness, you didn't mean that. And then the question, when they have understanding, you can then ask the next question, which is, okay, if we get to that situation again, What would we do differently? And that's where I think a lot of the tools and the vocabulary and the language of the giant stuff becomes very valuable. Because as John, as an ENFP, says, guys, look, I'm going to share this with all the passion in the world. Please know that when you bring critique, I feel it personally.
Yeah,
I'm going to try and stay engaged as long as I can. And please ask your questions. But can you add a little bit of celebration before you bring the critique when you try and collaborate? Gene goes, sure, I could do that. And Gene, when you ask the questions, remember that you can be right and wrong at the same time. You can be right in the question you ask and wrong in the tone and tact with which you ask it. So, Gene, I want you to practice offering a celebration first, telling John why you want to collaborate, and then being, am I okay to ask my questions? So Gene may turn around and go, John, this is really good. I really like this. I think you may have discovered something that could be incredibly valuable for our team and organization. But I would love your permission to bring my superpowers, which are really to ask difficult questions, to do due diligence, to run a pilot for us. Because before we go live and bet everything on this,
yeah,
we probably ought to do the due diligence. I'd love to do that because that's my superpower I've been given. I couldn't do this if you hadn't brought your superpower to find a solution and a possibility through this that you've spent so much time working your way through. And I really honor you for that. Are you good with us asking some difficult questions? Not because I'm trying to hurt you, but because I think it's really great. And I want to make sure that when we go live with it, it's the best it can possibly be. Are you good with that? Well, John has no problem with a guardian who wants to help him make it better. And to actually do the due diligence so that Gene will go, and by the way, John, if I do a pilot and I find this works and I trust it, I'd love to help you communicate to the wider organization why I think this is a really great idea. That's how I deal with it.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. I like that so much. I'm gonna throw you another scenario.
Go on.
Okay, so Mary is a nurture guardian. She's leading a successful, very collaborative meeting. Mike is the Guardian Pioneer boss, and he walks in and unintentionally hijacks the room. He just says, I'm just going to observe. But then come all the disruption questions, and the energy shifts from collaboration to defensiveness. The meeting ends with frustration, a little bit of resentment. Mike later says, I was just asking questions. But as you look around the room, to give you a scenario, everything's smiling, happy, and everything else. And then Mike comes in, and you can just see the faces change, the demeanor, one person shaking. And there's this just tension, so much that you could cut it with a knife. How would you coach Bill and Mike in that situation?
Okay.
Or not Bill and Mike, but Mary and Mike. Mary and Mike.
So again, I would put up on the board, Mary, ISFJ, Nurture Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, Guardian Pioneer, ESTJ. Now, interestingly, there's more likely to be synergy between these two than there is in the other. The issue is Mary is a Nurture Guardian, as the leader must be a pretty significant and confident woman. Because to be a woman, nurture a guardian, and be in a place where you're the executive team leader, somebody has sponsored you. Somebody has believed in you, and someone has said, I believe you can do this. Because nurturers will never put themselves forward for promotions to say they think they're better than their peers, unless somebody champions them. So we've got quite a significantly competent woman here who is trusted, is highly attuned to the needs of others in the group, and deeply committed to other people being heard, valued, and appreciated. So the honest answer is, if Mike did this to Mary, as he's not the leader, it's more likely that Mary would end up pressing pause on the conversation and go, Mike, you know, I love your questions, but I think it might be better if you and I had a conversation offline, because I want to do justice to what you're saying. We don't have the time right now, or it feels like you're a long way away from where I am. So Mary would be much more compassionate towards Mike, because inherently Mary would be tempted to blame herself first. And in the end, if Mike is bringing questions, Mary will always appreciate what the person is bringing before she feels the critique of what's there. Now, if Mary's not confident, Okay, if Mary is, but it's very hard to get an ISFJ nurturer guardian leader who hasn't had a significant amount of self-awareness of work. They both kind of value the guardian voice, Jim. So Mary might use a bit of humor and go, "Hey, Jim, I love your questions. Remember, guardian's my second voice. Remember, though, I'm a nurturer, so this feels personal. So can you ask the questions in a way that actually affirms we aren't completely useless and that we haven't made heinous mistakes on the way? How can you mix the critique with celebration so I feel like you're collaborating with me in us as a team in order to get the best outcome?" But it's highly likely that a nurturer guardian and a guardian pioneer will find a way, because if you put pioneer guardian and we had an ENTJ, then we might have a different ego issue. But the guardian and the nurturer are a lot closer together than you think.
Okay. Well, these are great scenarios. This is really good. Bringing this all together, Steve, one of the things I believe is the best way to really start and be a catalyst to learn this stuff is immersion. And you have coming up in Oklahoma the annual gathering, and you're going to do the Five Voices end of September. Was it the 28th, 29th in September?
I trust you more than I do me, Jim, for details.
I will have the actual dates and the opportunity to enroll. Why is it important? And tell me a little bit about this conference that you're putting on in Oklahoma City, and you're flying all the way over from
Yeah, from London, and Mrs. Cockrum's coming as well. So
yeah.
anyone who's ever followed the story knows that Helen is the nurturer guardian, without whom most of this stuff wouldn't have happened. So I think one thing, Jim, there's two pieces to it. One is we're launching a new book, The Voice-Driven Leader, which I actually really proud of, and in a sense it's one of those field guides. We spend so long trying to help team leaders do a good job, but most of the time our work goes into the executive teams or the one below where they can afford it. But the biggest cultural determinant in any organization is your first level leaders, because they ultimately touch half your employees. And so the question is, how do you develop them? How do you grow them? And every leader I know wants to do a good job, but they don't have the tools to do it. So this is really practical, saying, if I'm going to be a good team leader, based on how I'm wired and the people I'm leading, how do I have a clues of how I did it? So that's going to be the beginning of Voices. People are going to be able to come. It will be a lot of people will share. Everyone will go away, we're saying, with their own development plan for themselves and the development plan for the people they lead. So we're fiercely practical, highly relational. Anytime you come and meet giants and meet the giant team and meet people who live it and breathe this stuff, it's just a shot in the arm. A lot of people run their own businesses, they might have small teams, but it's a bit like the festival experience, coming and actually learning together, sharing together, eating together, a glass of something together, if that's what you want to do as well. And you'll find that there is no ego in giant. You'll find that all the people that you've listened to will be there and take huge joy and delight in actually spending time with people. So it's not just a, star on the stage and good luck in the green room. It's we'll be around in the evenings, we'll be around over lunches and coffees and answer and basically help people be the best they can be. So, that's the Voices conference. It's the launch of a book. It'll be highly applied. It'll be informative, relationally engaging, a lot of fun as we walk around to different eateries. And that's the best I've got. English are terrible at selling things, but I'm coming all the way from London. So if that's good enough, come and see me, if nothing else.
Oh, I'm very excited about it. Now, this would be the third kind of giant gathering I've been to, and this is going to be a little bit different. One of the things that I notice is the caliber of people there are probably the most healthy people that I've been around. It is just stunning the caliber of people that go to these things. So if you want to be around a good group of healthy people who really are masters of coaching and leadership and understand the five voices, and just to get to know it for the first time, this is a wonderful opportunity to, it's right in the middle of the United States. It's easy to get to, and it's a fun area. I don't know if you've been to Oklahoma City, but it's a pretty neat little place. The other thing for people who are wanting to know more about Five Voices, granted, I'm going to have a link in the description here where somebody can take and figure out what their voice is. It takes about 15 minutes. And they get a little bit of a snapshot of what their voice is. If they want to get the full version, it doesn't cost much more to, you know, get the full printout of that. They can do that. But there's also the Five Voices book out there, which is really good. And I was listening to it again this week for, I think, the third time. And it seems like there's been some variations. Did you update that book?
We've updated the front covers. I'm not sure we've rewritten it, but like with most things, I suspect there's some evolution of thinking. The principles are evergreen, but undoubtedly, I mean, it was probably 8 years ago we wrote that, but I don't know how long ago it was, but it was a long time ago. But luckily, most of what we write is evergreen. But, you know, if you go to fivevoices.com or you put a link in, there's a lot of resources you can do, whether, you know, certainly compared to where we started. There's a lot more ways that people can engage and learn. There's apps, there's, you know, even you can have your own Five Voices AI coach now. It knows me, it knows all the people in my relational orbit. I can ask it anything, even down to what should I get my wife Helen for a birthday present. So you can, there's no excuse for not being self-aware and relationally intelligent in the world that we now live. It just requires an intentionality and a willingness in some ways to work on yourself. But I say to most leaders, I go, you're never going to waste this. Becoming more relationally intelligent, knowing yourself and knowing how to relate to the other people around you. I always say to leaders, I go, it's slightly provocative. I said, if you want to be the best you can possibly be, you need to learn how to love generously, speak life, and begin with the end in mind. Because
love that.
Love generously means I'm going to learn enough about you to understand what it means to fight for your highest possible good. And so therefore, I'm going to be as generous as I can, not to do to you just what I would want, but I'm going to learn what brings you alive, and I'm going to speak life. So here's the thing. A lot of the time in my past, I would be trying to speak life, but people heard it as critique.
Mm.
I spent a long time trying to work out words are amazing when they're done well, but you'd be amazed how many people carry wounds from the past of things that were said to them from years back they carry. So I would say, you know, learn how to speak life into your people, into your family and your kids. What is it that is authentic? What is it that you can bring? And begin with the end in mind, which is, well, what, firstly with yourself, what legacy do you want to leave? What do you want people to say at your funeral? That's what I say.
Yeah.
And ultimately as well with the people you may be leading, a lot of your employees probably won't stay with you for 40 years anymore.
Yeah.
What are you doing with them that's helping them grow, develop? They'll walk through plate glass for you, but your job at times will probably be to go, how do I help you onto the next thing that is for you? So I always try and break things down so that I can remember them. So whenever I meet someone, I'm going, how do I love generously? Actually, how do I put your needs ahead of mine? And how do I learn how to do that well? How do I speak life always? And what's the end in mind for this relationship? Well, it's different for my children or my wife or colleagues I work with, but I may meet somebody, as I will at the Voices Conference, maybe you, or maybe somebody listening, I promise you, you will experience, if we spend a bit of time together, you'll feel that I care. And hopefully you'll feel that most of the giants, the reason why they're healthy, Jim, is you can't give what you don't possess. It's really hard. It's really hard to give life to others when you're not alive yourself.
That's so good. That's so good. And I would add one caveat. You know, the thing that I have found getting to know Steve through his books, through the Five Voices app, through the Five Voices, is I found myself become more influential, a better communicator. And in the end, I have more joy and happiness, because there's nothing better as far as a feeling of having significant influence in somebody's life and being able to truly communicate to somebody, that it's a game changer. So, Steve, I want to thank you for all of your hard work and effort into this, because it's not only impacted me, it's impacted my family and everyone that I've come in contact with. And I really, really appreciate you. And I thank you for doing this podcast as well. And hopefully we'll get thousands of views and more people who are jumping onto the giant bandwagon, or the Five Voices bandwagon.
Thank you, Jim. That's so kind of you. I mean, I think the thing is that Eric Liddell said, didn't he, when I run, I feel my father's pleasure. In a sense, helping when people genuinely want to learn about the type of things I've spent a lifetime, usually learning through failure. I mean, I think that's the, you know, I think Henry Nouwen wrote a book called The Wounded Healer, didn't he? He said that basically it's so much easier to learn from somebody who's already struggled with this. You know,
yeah.
I would say, you know, helping somebody who's dealing with bereavement or with loss of a child, it's like, it's so much easier if you've been there before. And I would say that basically somebody like me was one of the least emotionally intelligent, relationally intelligent, self-aware 30-year-olds. So I think a lot of it comes with hopefully a level of humility, which says, hey, this is a life's work of trying to learn not how to be an arsehole and trying to be a better husband and a better colleague. But I'm still learning. And you said something earlier, which is the tendencies don't change. So self-awareness gives me choice. But it doesn't solve it for me. I don't take a pill and suddenly I become emotionally intelligent, relationally intelligent, do the right thing. It's repetition over time of committing to the work in me and then usually enjoying the fact that people experience something different. So when people like you give me an opportunity just to answer questions and share what I think about things, you're getting an overflow of many, many, many years of trying to wrestle with and trying to work out how can I help people be better at doing this than I was earlier in my life, because then they've got more time where they can actually make a much more positive difference as pioneers than perhaps I did. But thank you.
So good. So good. Any parting thoughts for people out there wanting to know more?
Gosh, I mean, as a Brit, no, I'm sure you will be far better, Jim, at basically, you know, people can find things in the show notes. They can find me on LinkedIn. I always say that basically, if you're brave enough to reach out and say hi, I will, and particularly if the things that interest you, always happy to find me and engage that way. But you can give them links to go and take a five voices assessment or find out a bit more. We're good at doing that once people engage.
Thanks. I appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in a few months. And hopefully somebody will see this podcast and want to join us as well.
Fantastic. There you go, Jim. I'll say basically, if anyone sees the podcast and comes to Oklahoma, they can contact us and we'll basically have coffee or lunch with them during the time we're there. How's that?
Sounds great.
They've got to get a quote from Jim Coteng's podcast, though, in order to really claim the prize. So that's how we'll know.
Oh, yeah. There's going to be a special prize if you name the podcast. You know, we'll let that be a dopamine hit for you right now. Curious. What is it? What is this special prize?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Cheers for now. Say hello to everyone across the pond for me, and we will see you soon.
Bye-bye.